This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit. It's true. It's true.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys.
Welcome, one and all, to the 197th, I believe, episode of the longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation. That was a shoddy execution, but nonetheless, we are the longest-running weekly, etc. And we are back for, my gosh, Nick, yet another edition.
I think we should just change it to that, the longest running weekly, et cetera.
Et cetera, at this point. I mean, we've earned that right. Yep. We are rapidly approaching 200 episodes every week, Nick, for the last, oh gosh, almost 4 years of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And we are continuing our month-long tribute to a show that has been there the entirety of our show and longer, Arrow, a show that has been near and dear to our hearts for a long time. We're continuing our month-long tribute to celebration of, mourning of, the show, which is coming to an end at the end of this very month. In fact, next week will be the final episodes of Arrow. So we are back in the studio. Nick, how are you doing on this fine whenever it is we're recording this?
Oh, I'm doing okay. I'm doing okay. Hanging in there anyway. Still mourning the loss of our beloved Oliver Queen, as we discussed last week. But looking forward to see what the last couple episodes of Arrow hold. Looking forward to talk about some more classic Arrow here tonight.
Indeed. I myself have had a bit of a rough day as we're recording this. I had a sickness for the duration of most of the day.
Yes.
And now I've overcome that sickness.
Legitimate sickness and not just a bullshit excuse to call out of work and waste taxpayer dollars.
It was legitimate. I've got the, well, I don't want to say any more, but I've got the something to prove it. But
the bubble guts.
Nonetheless, I've overcome it. I've overcome the odds, like John Cena in 2007, and I'm here to make this show happen. So,
hey, if you're John Cena in 2007, maybe you can have a really overrated match with Umaga.
I believe you mean Umanga.
Yeah, good point.
Still a hater, Nick, after all these years.
Hey,
you haven't risen above.
I grew into giving the man some props. I just find that one particular match to be among the most overrated things in history.
Things in history? More overrated.
Considering there are people who have it as like a top five all time company.
True.
Pack,
yeah.
That's, you know, fair. What I mean?
Like, oh, I know what you mean. I also fall on the side of it being overrated, although good but overrated.
Yeah, good but overrated. Exactly.
You know. Where does it stand in the pantheon of overrated things? I don't know. Is it more or less overrated than the Roman Empire, for instance? I don't know.
The Roman Empire is appropriately rated.
Well, I mean, if they were that good, why didn't they last longer?
Mm.
In any event, we are here to bring to you a second edition of Off the Page this month for Arrow Month. And appropriately enough, we are going to revisit two episodes of Arrow tonight. We are going to revisit the two episodes that we consider to be the pinnacle of Arrow. That's right. Earlier in the month, we had our countdown of our five favorite Arrow episodes, and these are the two episodes that finished one and two on each of our respective lists, just flip-flopped. These episodes come to us from season three, episode 9, The Climb, and also from season 5, an episode titled Capuchon. Now, I had...
What's that now?
Capuchon. Mm. You had Capuchon at number one and The Climb at number two. I had Climb at number one and Capuchon at number two. And so we thought it appropriate to revisit these episodes and kind of see how they stand the test of time and delve into what makes these episodes tick, what makes them stand out as truly the pinnacles of Arrow to this point anyway. So without any further ado, we're not going to watch both episodes as we record. However, I have got Season 3, Episode 9, The Climb, pulled up on Netflix. The entirety of Arrow, of course, is available to watch on Netflix, and we highly encourage you to do so if you haven't watched the show, or even if you have. So I have got it at the very beginning, and I am going to hit the play button in 3, 2, 1, play. Right now we're going through the recap.
Dare to Defy.
Yeah. For some reason, it started me about 7 seconds in already, so I'm going to pause it for about right there.
Oh, there's that bastard Ray Palmer putting the moves on Felicity.
Oh, yeah. What a... Remember how nervous we were at the time that they were just going to move on from Oliver and Felicity at the time?
Yeah, we weren't convinced it was actually going to happen until they actually got married. And exactly. Even then, we were convinced they were going to get divorced the entire time.
Yeah, yeah. We were just convinced that they were going to... We were just waiting on the other laurel-shaped shoe to drop. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, it never did.
Yep. Or then Dinah became a legit. We thought we were worried that Dinah was going to be the one eventually.
To the point that we were actively rooting for Diggle to cheat on his wife with Dinah.
Yeah, just to get Dinah out of the
picture. Get Dinah out of the equation.
Yeah.
So the as mentioned, the first episode we're looking at, this is the mid-season finale of Season 3, and it is titled appropriately enough, "The Climb." The very first shot of the episode proper is Oliver Queen in the middle of the night, dead of darkness, climbing a mountain somewhere. And he's wearing, you know, thick clothing, so it's clearly cold. He's climbing the mountain one by one, and then it flashes to 48 hours earlier to establish where we're at in our status quo. And is this Arnold Flass, by the way?
I think it's Hagrid from the Harry Potter films.
Ah. Well, either way, he's fat!
Yes.
And, this is a good scene, too, I thought. I had forgotten this actually happened, where Oliver gets ambushed by the League.
This is crazy, because I was just watching Arrow. I've been doing a rewatch, as we discussed on last week's episode. And I was just watching some Season 3 before we did this podcast, so it's kind of funny. I think I'm about four... this is jumping ahead like 4 episodes from where I am. I think I just finished episode 4 of Season 3, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, you are breezing through your rewatch, by the way. You're already into Season 3.
Well, I'm putting it on... You know, I've seen all these before, so I'm putting it on while I play Madden on my PS4, and so I've kind of got a dual-screen type thing going, so it's like, you know... I'm catching most of it, but I can't say I'm, like, watching for every little detail.
Ah, Nyssa. How I miss you. So this is setting up, you know, the status quo of how we are at this point in the series. Picking this episode up again, Nick, because I'm still in Season 1 on my rewatch. I'm about close to halfway through Season 1, and I had forgotten kind of what the status quo was at this point in the climb. So you have, obviously you had...
Season 3 opens, the first episode, Sarah comes back to Starling City after leaving near the end of season two. She comes back in the season 3 season premiere, and then is murdered by an unknown assailant in the closing moments of that episode. And then the first part of the season, they kind of think it might be Malcolm Merlyn, but Malcolm swears to Oliver on Thea's life that it isn't him, and he believes Malcolm because he thinks he actually does care about Thea and whatnot. And so at that point, because he doesn't want Thea to undergo any loss or whatever, Oliver actually places Malcolm under his protection as it relates to the League. So while he is investigating who Sarah's killer actually is, he's also having to protect Malcolm from League assassins who are trying to take him out. So that's kind of the status quo as we enter this. Laurel is attempting to train to be a vigilante, poorly for the most part, being trained by what I consider to be a pretty bad version of Ted Grant, Wildcat, let's be honest, not that great. And so, yeah, that's kind of what you have have going on. Meanwhile, Thea and Merlin have been off in Corto Maltese for during the break between seasons 2 and 3, but they are both pretending like that didn't happen, like they don't really have a relationship. So now Thea, the person who has been mad at everybody for telling lies and keeping secrets, is now telling lies and keeping secrets.
And that plays heavily into this episode, in fact.
Right.
One of the primary sort of through points of this episode is Oliver coming to terms with the fact that Thea has been lying to him, because all of Thea's, or at least a portion of Thea's secrets, come to the surface in this episode. And Oliver, against the advice of his friends, refuses to believe that Thea could be betraying him, could be lying to him like this about Malcolm, who she learned in the previous season was her biological father. And so Thea, who has no family left except for Oliver and Malcolm, is sort of trying to exist between the two worlds right now, and those worlds are about to collide in a big way in this episode.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, the League of Assassins, they have a stake in this game because Sarah was a member of the League of Assassins, so they're out for revenge. They want whoever killed her's head on a pike, and they believe the killer to be Malcolm Merlin. And as long as Oliver protects Malcolm Merlin, they're going to wreak havoc on Starling City, at this point, until Oliver can deliver unto them what they are promised. And also, we had the introduction, I forgot, of Ray Palmer in season 3. I had actually forgotten this was the Ray season. And
Oliver has run his company into bankruptcy twice in 2 seasons. And so for some reason, the investors don't want to turn control over the company back over to him after the events of season 2. So in sweeps Ray Palmer to purchase Queen Consolidated and use it as an opportunity, their Applied Sciences division, as an opportunity to help him develop his Atom suit, which we're going to get our first glimpse of in holographic form, actually, in this episode.
Yeah, what did you make of seeing Ray in this episode? Was it as kind of...
Well, remember, I'm watching season 3, though. So
I went from watching Legends, obviously. I just watched the premiere last night of the new season, to watching this version of Ray, and it was like, it was almost a little bit of a whiplash effect for me. He's still the same character. You can see the hints there, but it's a character much more steeped in tragedy at this point, much more
grounded.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it would be weird to have the Legends version of Ray as a regular occurring character on Arrow, especially with this season of Arrow, which is, as we'll discuss here in a little bit, going for such a grim and dark tone, much like Arrow has, you know, throughout its entire history to this point. So what Ray brings is some much needed levity, I think, to the proceedings. He has been a pretty funny character. Mm-hmm. He and Felicity do have good chemistry on screen, even if at the time and to this day, we do not want that romantic entanglement. As dedicated Olicity shippers, but this is I think Ray adds something to the show and has been pretty good based on the few episodes of season 3 I've watched, and also in this episode as well, although he is not the focus. The focus is squarely on Oliver and the League in this one.
Yes, and he also looks so healthy and youthful. we've talked about this, and we talked about it particularly on our countdown show, Nick. The best episodes of Arrow, the best seasons of Arrow, are the ones that remember the central idea, which is that Oliver Queen is the best character on the show.
Right.
Oliver Queen is the focal point. Oliver Queen is why we're watching, for the most part. And I think the lesser seasons are the ones that kind of get away from that point, and the greater seasons are the ones that stay to that point while managing to weave the other characters into Oliver's, you know, narrative through point. But this in particular stands out to me as one of the great episodes. We'll talk about how these two episodes kind of parallel one another in some ways, as you hear Scott Steiner making his entrance in the background of my apartment.
Mm.
But my God, that's a long siren. The two episodes parallel one another because
you mean in the background of
Hoholoon Plaza, right? The Vancouver Police Department is just in hot pursuit of someone right now.
Isn't it odd how Canadian police sirens sound no way like American police sirens?
Yes, absolutely. Scott Steiner makes his entrance the same way everywhere.
That's right.
But anyway, both of these episodes are personal stories for Oliver. And they stand out as such. And one of the things that I mentioned about this episode in the countdown, Nick, was that you could almost watch this episode divorced from the status quo, divorced from the season around it, and it still works. And I found that to be the case, even though I mentioned there were some things that, you know, caused my head to turn a little bit, like Ray and, you know, the status quo with Thea, which I had forgotten. But quite honestly, this episode, as we're viewing it, shapes up and forms around a central idea of inevitability. Does it not?
Yes, it does. We haven't quite gotten to that point yet because we haven't gotten the setup, the crux of this episode, but eventually it will definitely develop into that.
We should all... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, we should also mention that the flashbacks are still going on at this point in the show. This would be the third year of the flashbacks, I believe.
Yeah, we got 5 years of flashbacks, and I would argue this is the second weakest season of flashbacks, in my opinion.
Yeah, probably. I would probably agree with that.
It's not as bad as the name as the as
oh,
the,
that one was brutal. Yeah.
The return to the island in season 4 where they were hunting for the magical artifacts or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's not as good as season 5's Russia flashbacks,
right,
or either of the first two seasons of the island.
I agree with that very much so. But I did enjoy the characters of Tatsu and Maseo. Yeah.
Their dead son, who I've forgotten the name of.
Their dead son. What a macabre statement, but true nonetheless.
Is he their son?
I think so.
Is he dead?
Yes.
He's their dead son.
Very well. You know, Macaulay Culkin was the good son.
And then at the end, he was the dead son.
I guess they didn't want to have a sequel to that one, the better son.
His long lost twin comes back as the better son. Sadly, we knew all along.
Hey, it turns out your first kid was evil. He's Satan incarnate. Yes, we knew all along, sadly.
How do they not know? Remember the mom in that movie, how stupid she was? Yes. Like, just pretending like nothing was wrong.
Remember every mom in every Satan incarnate child movie being stupid? Yes.
Well, no, but in other Satan incarnate movies like The Omen or Rosemary's Baby or whatever, they're at least, you know, somewhat afraid of their kid. This mom was just like, no, he's fine. There's nothing wrong.
Remember that one Twilight Zone episode that had the evil kid, but everybody was smart, so they were afraid of him, so they just did whatever he wanted them to do?
Vaguely.
Anyway, that's off topic. But the
private Drip Oliver says.
Oh, my. Oh, Oliver and Roy intimidating this poor pilot. This is good stuff. That's right. So the flashbacks are still going on. And in the flashbacks, what's going on is they're trying to stop the release of this chemical weapon in Hong Kong.
The Omega virus, yes.
The Omega virus, which is our only, to this point, allusion to, I believe, to Darkseid or any of that stuff in the Arrowverse. It's not really a flat-out allusion to Darkseid. It's just kind of an Easter egg for comic book fans, primarily.
Right.
Sort of like the Atom suit was in the beginning.
We got to remember that at this point in the Arrowverse, Flash had just started, so they were still relatively grounded. Like the Mirakuru, which was based off a scientific chemical formula, was as big and as zany as they had gotten on Arrow. Mm-hmm. And sadly, they would continue down that road to almost disastrous effects, as we've discussed in season 4.
And there was the footage that proved to Oliver that Thea had been in contact with Merlin as they arrived in Star City. So that this is another element of Oliver's evolution as a character and devolution in some ways, because Oliver, while he's been hard around the edges and while he's been cynical and brutal and aggressive at times, he's kind of been softening as the seasons have progressed a little bit. But the one area where he's always had a blind spot is Thea, even back to season 1.
Well, yeah, and having done some rewatching lately, he's kind of been progressively losing his blind spots over the course of the show to this point. You know, when he first returns from the island, he has blind spots for his mom, Thea, and of course Laurel. And in season 1, he kind of has to lose that blind spot for Laurel to a certain extent, and then it kind of becomes finalized in season 2. Then, of course, also near the end of season 2, he loses the blind spot for his mom. And here, Thea is kind of the last real you know, she can do no wrong in his life. And mm-hmm. once he loses that in this episode, he kind of has really doesn't really have any of his pre-existing relationships. Like, he's still got relationships with these people, but they're never going to be the same as they were early on in the show's run.
Exactly. And it almost feels like it contributes to Oliver's willingness to jump into things at the end. The fact that he doesn't feel like he really has a whole lot to lose.
Right.
In his personal life, even if subconsciously. So this, one of the things about this is where it all starts to come together in the episode, where you start to realize, okay, Thea is hiding something. Who is the real killer of Sarah? They find Oliver, they find Queen DNA on the arrow that killed Sarah. And there's that thought that Oliver instantly has that Malcolm Merlyn planted his DNA on the arrow, that he actually did kill Sarah. However, the evidence is starting to line up that it was Thea that killed Sarah, which is something that Oliver just cannot process. He knows that she would never do it intentionally, but he just can't figure out how this could be, that his beloved Speedy would have put an arrow through her friend and his ex-lover. So a lot of threads going on here with that mystery. The League is encroaching upon town. And one of the things about the League of Assassins, Nick, as villains in Arrow, is pretty much from before they arrive, even when they're just hinted at in season 2, I believe it is, and when they show up, there's never any doubt about their effectiveness.
They show up en masse at the end of season 2 to help Oliver battle the Mirakuru army, and them in action is pretty damn satisfying.
Yeah, and it's not like you see sometimes the League of Assassins in other media, where they're kind of disposable thugs. When they show up in season 3, these are elite technicians that don't take long to take Oliver down. Who we've established that Oliver is a high level fighter on the show, and he's taken down pretty easily by the League. There's never any consideration that Oliver and his friends can actually take out the League of Assassins in a straight up battle. And so right. and so Oliver is now kind of facing
Does anybody remember how Thea and Oliver, who supposedly have lost their entire fortune, got this palatial apartment, penthouse apartment?
Well, one could ask how they managed to fund anything after season 2.
Yeah.
What
is Oliver doing for a living right
yes,
now?
Yes, how does Oliver get an endless supply of arrows?
Yeah.
Now, in fairness, if you remember in that Arrow 2.5 comic, they show him and Diggle buying shipments from this weapons manufacturer guy, although the guy mentions that they haven't paid up in months. So you would think that guy would eventually stop supplying them if they don't make the payments, right? Unless right. Lila's hooking up Diggle with some of that sweet Argus money.
There you go.
This is another interesting part of these flashbacks too, Nick, having watched Capuchon more recently, is one thing that these flashbacks did a great job of, particularly, not so much the season 4 ones, but particularly this one, showing Oliver's descent into what he would become.
Yes, and we will talk about this in a little bit, but arguably the most effective flashback of all time in that regard is the Capuchon flashback, which is, of course, completely intentional to establish the present-day story that's being told there, but we'll talk about that just a little bit.
Yes.
I have forgotten entirely whatever happened to Laurel and Sarah's mom. Like, I know she leaves the show at
some
point.
Yeah, I don't remember either.
Never to be seen again, but I do not recall when or why.
I don't either. I honestly can't recall that either. And the other thing is, it makes me sad because now I remember that Felicity's mom exists on the show. We haven't seen her in a long time.
That's right.
Mama Smoke. But yeah, so Oliver is getting ready to try to take on the League of Assassins and trying to do that while we're seeing these flashbacks that are showing as he's kind of having to interrogate people for the first time. And we just saw him, you know, put an arrow into a suspect that he's trying to intimidate and interrogate. And, you know, at this point, Oliver is in the flashbacks. Oliver's still uncomfortable with all this stuff. Or at least he seems to be uncomfortable with all this stuff. By the time we get to the season 5 flashbacks, the last year of his quote-unquote captivity on the island, by that point, Oliver no longer shies from it. He actually actively embraces it and seems to have taken it to levels that, that some would consider to be unnatural. Oh, and this is Ra's al Ghul. We were talking about this offline earlier. Ra's was done magnificently on this show. Just a standout villain. One of the best takes on Ra's that we've seen. And not that there's really been a bad one that I can remember. But he carries that majesty of Ra's, but he's also, there's no question again about his effectiveness. There's no question at all that this dude is the ultimate badass. He is the god tier villain right now of the Arrowverse, at this point in the Arrowverse, because he seemingly is never even in jeopardy. Like he's got this command about him. He carries himself like a dark side figure would, where, you know, he's in complete command of these troops. And he's got this noble air about him. Matt Nabel, I believe, is the actor's name, and he does a tremendous job here.
Yes.
And from the intro, you see him wipe out a group of like six trained assassins coming after him in training. And he's a guy that commands respect instantly when you see him. And granted, there have been villains like that in the past where when they finally have a showdown with the hero, they get their ass kicked. As we find out in this episode, not so with him. Ra's al Ghul is the rare villain who makes a promise and follows through on his promises.
Yes. Yes. The comparison we drew at the time was that it was the John Cena Brock Lesnar of superhero action sequences, and that's kind of what it is. Like we'll get there. Well, I don't know that we'll get there, you know, in this episode, but man, it is decisive and heartbreaking, and you keep waiting for some sort of hope spot or turnaround. You keep thinking, oh, well, here it comes, and then it just never comes.
I thought this was a really interesting scene as well. Thea, you get the sort of Thea kind of sweetly looking at her and Oliver's childhood Christmas ornaments, and then the Green Arrow arrives to interrogate Thea about where she's been, and she fights back, and she shows off these fighting skills that she never had before.
Wearing 2000 era Chris Jericho pants, by the way.
Yes, and Oliver now is stunned because his innocent little sister has clearly been trained by Malcolm Merlyn, and has been trained pretty well. So that's an interesting thread as well here. So we might as well go ahead and talk about this episode. Feels like a funeral dirge because it is. In some ways, this whole episode feels like a man who is marching towards his fate. As we progress in this episode, things get more hectic. The action gets more tense around the character. Here, Oliver is encountering Malcolm Merlyn, and Malcolm lays his cards out on the table. This is another thing this episode did, Nick. Malcolm is such an amazing character. We've talked about it before on the show. He is the ultimate snake of the Arrowverse, of any of the shows, because he's that guy that will convince you that he's turned over a new leaf and convince characters that he's turned over a new leaf, but it's always in self-service. Always. Every time in this show that he claims that he cares about Thea, maybe he does on some level, but it's always to get some benefit, as we find out later when he uses Thea to gain power over the League of Assassins, when he uses leverages Thea against his own mortality at a later point. Malcolm is the ultimate guy who's out for himself first and foremost, and he's going to trick and connive and maneuver his way through it, almost like the Lex Luthor figure, which we just saw in Crisis. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Like, he is the ultimate schemer as it relates to Arrow, to the very end even. And I remember you and I both being convinced he would pop up again before the show's end, and sadly that didn't happen. But yeah, Malcolm is outstanding.
John Barrowman plays Malcolm and does a marvelous job, totally unlike any of the characters I've seen him play before. But anyway, so this is about Oliver slowly comes to terms with the fact that the only way out of this, we find out that Malcolm put his own daughter under a hallucinogenic spell that led to her murdering Sarah. And there's evidence of her murdering Sarah. And Malcolm, her own father, tells Oliver he's going to turn this evidence over to the League of Assassins. They will then kill Thea and take no matter what Oliver tells them about what Malcolm did, she pulled the trigger, so to speak. She'll be killed by the League. So Oliver has no choice but to challenge Ra's al Ghul to a blood duel, to a fight to the death for leadership of the League of Assassins.
Well, it's a trial by combat.
Trial by combat, right.
Yes, Oliver falsely confesses to murdering Sarah, and as a result, he is forced to partake in a trial by
combat. And for the record, Ra's, or Ra's, however you want to say it, knows that Oliver's lying. He tells him at one point, he said, I'm less offended by your rejection of my... Or by what you did to my daughter's beloved than I am that you take me a fool. So he doesn't believe Oliver, and yet he cannot refuse Oliver's challenge. So they prepare to fight. Oliver has to climb the mountain, and if he survives the climb, he can then encounter Ra's and try to put this whole thing behind him. And at least on the surface, Oliver puts out an air of confidence heading into this battle, because he even gives this is another brilliant thing about this episode. Every time in the past that we've seen Oliver give a dramatic speech about how motivated he is to do something, it's led to him winning the contest, whoever it was against. So in this case, he goes and he tells his friends what he's going to do, Felicity and Diggle. They try to talk him out of it, of course, and he says, no, I'm going to do this. And he has the utmost confidence. He said, I'm going to make it back. We're not going to have a dramatic goodbye. I'm going to make it back. We'll be fine. And I'm going to end this. And then Felicity says, but I don't have any doubt that you can beat him. I just want to make sure that you're willing to kill him, because you're going to have to kill him to end this. And Oliver kind of puts her at ease. And he says, I know what I'm fighting for now. I know what I'm fighting for. I'm fighting for my family. And all of that is to be said that it leads into the confrontation with the villain, and you're expecting, all right, he's fighting for his family. Oliver's going to find a way to outsmart and beat Ra's, and then
you think they're going to get out of it somehow, yeah, by ending a stalemate of some sort,
right?
Because you know it's like the ninth episode of the season; they're going to play it out across the entire season. So you're figuring a tie or Oliver winning a slight victory at best. None of us anticipated the degree to which Oliver's ass was going to be handed to him.
Yes. Nice little fight scene in the flashback, by the way, with China White versus who would become Katana, Tatsu.
Man, they were dead set on that China White character for what feels like 4 years.
Yeah. And she never really did that much of note.
Right.
She has her fight, a nice fight with Tatsu here. She would have a fight with her later on as well. I think she ends up killing Tatsu, actually, in one of these more recent seasons, but last season, in fact, I think it was. No, this season, when she shows up again. No, she survived. That's right. She gets stabbed, but she survived. Yeah, anyway, they had a confrontation, which was a callback, actually, to this fight in this episode. So you get the big confrontation on the mountaintop. And, Nick, how the best way to describe Ra's in this is just supremely confident. Right?
Yes.
Like, he has one hand behind his back as this battle starts. He lets Oliver choose his weapons. Oliver chooses two swords, and he says, you're unarmed. And what does Ra's tell him?
He says, I will take your weapons from you when you are through with them. And then he proceeds to disarm him and take his swords from him.
And what proceeds, that scene on the mountaintop, I texted you about this after I watched it, is one of the best, maybe the best sequence of cinematography in the history of Arrow. It looks like it came from a movie. Like, if you had told me, if you could take this and you could say Christopher Nolan directed this scene, I would have believed it, because it is sensational. For like a network television show, the fight choreography is great. The way that it is shot is so cinematic and epic. There's this feeling that you're watching these two titans collide, but in fact, what you're watching is the slow execution of the show's hero. He is completely outmatched by Ra's. He has no chance to win at any point. He gets a brief little flurry, and it does nothing. And Ra's kind of almost allows him to have it. And then he disarms him. He cuts death by a thousand cuts. He's cutting him all over the place. He's incapacitating Oliver. He gives him a little stab to the chest, drops him to his knees, and then basically gives him his last rites in Latin. And it's this scene where, like, Oliver is slowly, his life is flashing before his eyes. He's seeing all the people that he loved that he's lost. He's seeing all of this pain and hurt that he's gone through flash before his eyes. And at this point, as a viewer, like, what the hell is happening here? And then Raish plunges the sword into Oliver's chest and gives him his last rites, and then boots him off the side of the mountain. And you see Oliver's limp body just fall off the side of the mountain. End. Wow. Like, that is powerful. That was it's stunning to this day was the word that I used in our text exchange. Amazing cinematography, amazing editing, amazing acting from Nabal and from Amel, where you genuinely think your hero's just been killed. Obviously, you know he's going to come back somehow, but you're like, how are they going to get out of this? I remember, Nick, this memory just flashed to me as we were talking here. I remember the night that this aired, because you called me right after this episode aired, and you said, what the hell did we just watch? What the hell just happened? And I was like, I have no idea. What is going on? Like, what? Like, and I think any time a TV episode can make you have that reaction as a good thing. And
in a good way,
in a good way, not like a Monday Night Raw kind of way.
Or a Walking Dead kind of way.
Right. When you have that genuine reaction, that guttural reaction of like, holy shit, what did I just see? And where is it going to go? That's an amazing thing that's very difficult to replicate.
Agreed entirely. It's still one of the best examples of risky storytelling in the show's history. And yes, we all knew, even at the time, they were going to get out of it somehow. But, man, it was going to be fun to see how they did it. And we had to wait an agonizing, like, 7 or 8 weeks to figure out how they did it.
Because they did the mid-season break.
A cliffhanger they had not topped until very, very recently with the Crisis cliffhanger. So this is... This was good stuff, man. It was great to revisit.
And really, a cliffhanger is an appropriate term because it's almost a literal cliffhanger as he's left falling off of a cliff. but so in summary on this episode, what is it that you think makes this episode stand the test of time? For me, it did. I was blown away by it just like I was the first time I saw it. All the plot threads coming together, the emotional damage to Oliver by finding out what he finds out about Thea, and then the just physical destruction on a level that we're not prepared for our hero. That uncomfortable feeling that you saw people getting in that Brock Lesnar and John Cena match was what you had here as a viewer of watching the unconquerable hero get conquered in a way that he never had before. For me, this holds up sensationally well and stands out, as you said, as one of the great examples of brave, risky storytelling, but also an example of building a villain in a compelling way that makes the hero's eventual struggle that much more compelling. I was blown away by this episode.
Yeah, I was as well. Outstanding pretty much from beginning to end. And holds up, as you said, pretty much. I mean, I have a good bit more context recently than you do, but it still kind of holds up even out of context to a degree.
Well, one of the things that I think we should probably do right now, which is going to be a little difficult on live and recording, is switch over to Capuchon.
I've already got it pulled up.
Oh, I'm going to do that right now and go to my handy dandy more episodes here, over to season 5 and
episode 17.
And get this bad boy fired up. Hopefully it'll restart from the beginning for me. Mm-hmm. And there it goes loading. But I'm going to hit pause once it gets queued up.
Mm-hmm.
And the CW logo. And I'm going to go 3, 2, 1, play. All right. Now we're fast forwarding over 2 years at this point.
Yep.
And we are getting close to the end stretch here of season 5. Which has been all about Oliver's personal battle against Prometheus.
Yes.
And the mystery, the first half of the season is kind of about the mystery of who is Prometheus and how does this affect Oliver. and this burgeoning new team that he's attempting to form. And the second half is about why. Why is Prometheus coming after Oliver? And we're finding out that all of Oliver's past sins are coming back to haunt him in a way that was predicted by Slade Wilson, in a way that was predicted by Malcolm Merlyn, in a way that was predicted all the way back in his actions in season one. And we're seeing that right now. We're seeing the a flashback through Oliver's eyes of him being killing all of these people over the years when he became the Hood, the Arrow. And the status quo at this point is much different. There's another Team Arrow in place with John Diggle, Felicity Smoke, Mr. Terrific. Ragman, I think, is still on the show at this. No, he's probably gone at this point.
Ragman has already bailed by this point. Yeah. I think he bailed like midway through season four, if I remember correctly.
Wild Dog and the new Black Canary, Dinah Drake. And they are in place, but Oliver.
Oh, and Evelyn Sharp, briefly. Yes. Artemis, their version of Artemis.
Yes, Evelyn Sharp, who Oliver tries to make his protege. She ends up betraying the team on Adrian Chase's side, and then appears to defect from Adrian Chase's side, as we'll see in this episode. But yes, Prometheus has been revealed at this point in the season as being Adrian Chase, the district attorney, I believe, right? For Star City?
Yes, yes, and he is the district attorney.
He has been revealed as Prometheus, and he has a vendetta against Oliver because Oliver killed his father way back in season one because his father was on Oliver's dad's list of people that Oliver needed to take care of when he got back to Starling City. And in those days, Oliver had no aversion to killing, so he killed this guy's dad, and it made enough of an effect on Adrian that he built himself up, he trained himself, and he built himself up with the sole purpose of avenging his father and basically destroying Oliver Queen. But he doesn't want to just kill Oliver. As we find out here, he has captured Oliver. Oliver's chained up in a prison cell at Adrian's mercy. But Adrian's not interested in killing Oliver. He wants to kill him in a different way. He wants to destroy those that he loves, and he mainly wants Oliver to admit what he is. He wants Oliver to admit that he is every bit the monster that he's been claiming to be opposing all these years as a vigilante. And while this is going on, half of this episode is entirely in this prison cell where Adrian is trying to get Oliver to confess something. We don't know what it is. We just know that Adrian wants Oliver to confess to something, and Oliver's trying to figure out what it is. He doesn't know what Adrian wants from him either. So Adrian tries physical torture. He tries drowning him at the beginning of the episode, making him, you know, stay underwater for a ridiculous amount of time because he reveals that his dad died a slow and painful death as a result of what Oliver did to him. And then he ends up shooting the three arrows into Oliver. And then he ends up, bringing in Evelyn Sharp, as we'll find out later, to appeal to him emotionally. And threatens Felicity, threatens his son, William. All that's going on. We'll talk about that. The other half of this episode, though, is vital to what's going on in the present day, and that is the flashback to Russia. We are in the last year of the flashbacks, and Oliver and his friend Anatoly with the Bratva are attempting to take down Konstantin Kovar, played with brilliant malice by the great Dolph Lundgren, who really had a nice... this was the Lung Renaissance, really, at this time. When you factor in Creed 2 came out shortly after this. Arrow, of course, was going on. So we see Konstantin Kovar as this crime boss figure in Russia. And Oliver's on a personal vendetta against him because of a promise he made to a character best left forgotten the year before in the flashbacks. But nonetheless, that character was important because she ended up being the motivation for Oliver to go to Russia and pursue his vendetta against Konstantin Kovar. Well, in the process, Oliver, of the last 2 years of flashbacks, Oliver has found himself becoming more and more engrossed in this persona for himself, the Hood, this vigilante called Capuchon in Russia, who shows no mercy to his victims. He has no qualms about killing. He has no qualms about torture. In fact, I think you might agree with this, Nick, probably the standout flashback scene of this episode, to me anyway, was Oliver, the revelation of what Oliver does to the last guy that he interrogates, where he skins him alive.
Yep.
And he admits to Anatoly that the guy gave up pretty early and that the rest of it was just practice. I mean, that's damn cold-blooded. That's something that a psychopath would say.
Yes.
And Oliver's claim to Anatoly in the flashbacks is that the Hood is a different persona from Oliver Queen, that he's keeping them separate, sort of like Bruce Wayne and Batman. There's two different personas, but Anatoly makes it clear to him that, no, this is you. That's just an excuse you're making to cover up what you're doing, because basically you've become a cold-blooded killer. And Oliver doesn't want to accept that, either at that time or in the present day. And so, but what this does, Nick, is it shows you how Oliver becomes the guy that we meet in season one, who, you know, breaks a guy's neck in the first episode just to protect his secret. What do you make of the flashbacks in this episode? We can talk about his relationship with Anatoly. We can talk about Kovar, but in particular, how we see Oliver's descent into becoming kind of the monster that some of the villains have claimed that he is.
Yeah, it's especially fascinating when you have the context, and you even have a little bit of this, having rewatched some of season one lately and seeing the flashbacks to that very naive version of Oliver, that version of Oliver who isn't a physical threat to anyone, who doesn't want to hurt anyone, who is just kind of a bumbling idiot, and to see how far he's gone from wanting to protect everyone and see everyone be safe and happy to actively seeking out ways to torture people, it just drives home the journey that character has gone on over the 4 years of the flashbacks, and really serves as an outstanding counterpoint to the journey he's gone on over the four years of the present day. Because while he's grown, you know, as a hero, that he's come a long way from the person that he was way back in season one. And that is the point ultimately that Adrian Chase is trying to make, is that the person he was in season one was not a hero, not even kind of.
Yes, and I think that's also one of the sort of unspoken lessons of this episode that play out, is Oliver, as we'll talk about at the end of this episode, is a beaten and broken man, completely beaten and broken, in a more thorough way, arguably, than he was at the end of the climb. He was broken physically there. Here, he is broken mentally and spiritually. And yet,
he wants to quit. It's the first time he's ever just wanted to flat out quit.
Yep.
Like, he's had down moments where he wasn't sure if he could go on. He's had moments where he wasn't sure how they were going to pull it off, but he's never wanted to just give up on being the Arrow entirely. And at the end of this episode, he walks back into the bunker and he says, "I quit."
It's his Spider-Man No More moment. You know,
right.
But the kind of unspoken lesson here, if he had been in a better state of mind, Adrian makes the point at the end of the episode to him, "Do you really think that John Diggle and Felicity Smoke's lives are better because you've been in them?" But in fact, it's Oliver's life who's better because they've been in his life, because Felicity and Diggle have had the most impact on Oliver of anybody over the previous five seasons of Arrow, in changing him into the man that he is now, where he feels guilt about what he's done. He feels remorse, where he is compassionate, and he reaches out to people and tries to help them, where he can fall victim to someone like an Evelyn Sharp, whereas season one Arrow would not have fallen victim to that at all. He was too hard around the edges. And so it's interesting to see Oliver not being able to recognize the growth that he's gone on when he's in this position, because all he can see is the effects that he has on those around him. Everybody ends up dead or turning on him or their lives ruined, and that's how we get to that point. But I think the flashbacks are so key to that. One of the best relationships – we really haven't talked about this enough during Arrow Month, but one of the great relationships on this show is Anatoly and Oliver. From the very beginning, they've had an outstanding friendship and relationship that has been one of the backbones of this show. Anatoly's not on all the time. He's not on that frequently most of the time. But every time he's on here with Oliver, even if they're adversarial, they have a special relationship and a special bond to the point where that one half of a season, I think it was the back half of season six, where they were at odds with one another, didn't really feel right. You know, it didn't feel
right.
It didn't feel like what we wanted. We want, as an audience, we want these guys to be friends and brothers. And it's so good to see Anatoly in that stance here. You're constantly – the other thing about Anatoly is because he's not an essential character, quote-unquote, there's always the fear that he could be killed at any moment. So even though this is a flashback, so we know he's not going to be killed, there's always that thought of like something terrible could happen to him at any moment, even in the present day. And I think that's something that's kept his character compelling and strong throughout all these years.
Yeah, absolutely. From the moment he was introduced, and he was used sparingly in season two, but by the end of season two, you really believe and buy this bond between these two characters, and you want to see more of it. You want to see these two together. And you're right. When they were at odds, it was not the best thing in the world. It was nice to see them kind of reconcile near the end of that. And this is the big thing. If you're comparing Capuchon to the Climb, I think the advantage this has is the flashback. And that mm-hmm. advantage, I think, is largely in part or is largely due to the presence of Anatoly here.
Yes, and a firmly defined villain in the flashbacks in Kovar, which we didn't have in season three.
In the middle of the Lug Renaissance.
Yes. The other advantage that I think, you know, watching these two, both of them are amazing episodes. I went with The Climb as my number one because of the strength of that race plot. But one thing that I thought was a definite strength of this episode too, it's all Oliver. This episode is all Oliver. As far as I recall, there are no subplots here involving the other characters. We don't flash to see what's going on with Renee and Dinah. We don't flash to see what's going on with Felicity and John. It's all Oliver, whether it's the flashbacks or whether it's the present day. This is an Oliver Queen story, and I think that really helps it.
Yes, absolutely. There's no coincidence that, you know, in our estimation, the two greatest episodes in the show's history put Oliver at the forefront, at pretty much to the exclusion of the other characters. Yes, other characters have roles to play, but this is undisputedly Oliver's story in both of these episodes.
And we talked about the bold storytelling of stabbing Oliver in the chest and kicking his ass off a cliff to end the episode. That's incredible. But also bold to have an entire section, really the majority of this, of your episode, the big emotional strong point of your episode, take place in one room. Place with a villain interrogating your hero and them just talking. Because other than the beginning, when he tries to drown him and he shoots the arrows in him, Adrian doesn't do much physically to Oliver here, at least on camera. Adrian is emotionally torturing him. Adrian is trying to have a conversation with him to get Oliver to realize what he wants from him. Right, now, this is awesome.
Yeah, and he absolutely is physically torturing him as well. Right. And it's kind of cool here to see how Oliver is just sitting here saying, you know, I've been tortured before, and acting like it's no big deal. But you're right, it isn't the physical torture that gets through to him. Eventually, it's the things that he is saying and the things he is pointing out about Oliver's personality that eventually cause Ollie to break down.
And it's probably a combination of everything. It's the physical torture is wearing on him, and it's combining with the mental and emotional torture that Adrian's putting him through and reminding him of all of his failures and reminding him of the people that he's killed and reminding him of the allies who have fallen and all in his supposed quest for vengeance, because this whole time Oliver's deal has been, I'm out to save Star City. I want to make the city safe. But Adrian's point is you've never been out to make the city safe. You've been out to hurt people. You've been out,
right.
You just want to hurt bad guys. But it's a way for you to get out your own aggressions and get out your own, serve your own needs, basically. So, while the flashbacks are laying the groundwork of the monster that Oliver would become, really the crux of this episode is this interrogation scene as Adrian Chase stakes his claim as certainly in the running for the greatest Arrow villain. He's right there with Slade. I think most fans of the show would agree that those are your top two villains.
Yeah,
and, top and two. This is the episode I think you would probably agree, Nick. We need to rewatch the whole season, but I would say this is the episode where Adrian Chase becomes that. when this is over, there's no question. This is as personal a villain as Oliver Queen has ever had.
Right. The only thing that gives Slade the slight advantage is the years of backstory between he and Slade. But in terms of walking on and just creating a rivalry from the word go, this is an outstanding piece of writing by the writing staff.
And
Greg is chewing ice.
Yes, and Oliver says that he admits to killing Adrian's dad, but that's not what Adrian's after. And so, in a really clever plot here from Prometheus, he brings in Evelyn Sharp, who's playing the role of the sort of scared teenager that Oliver took under his wing, and she since betrayed the team. But now Adrian has tortured her, and he leaves them with a knife in the room, and says they're going to fight it out. And at the end of it, Oliver's going to have to kill her, and if he doesn't, he'll come in there and snap her neck. And this seems to be something of a breaking point for Oliver, because he doesn't kill her, and Adrian comes in and he picks her up and seemingly breaks her neck. And that seems to be a breaking point for Oliver, where he sees yet another person fall. And then we get into what I thought was the best part of the episode and one of the best 5-minute stretches ever on Arrow, which is that last, like, what would you say it was, Nick? 5 to 6 minutes of the episode where they flash back and forth between the two simultaneous plots. You get a moment in the cell of the interrogation. You go back to Oliver's fight with Konstantin Kovar, and they split back and forth. And there's this simultaneous action scene in the past and emotional scene in the present. And if I need to rewatch it to really be sure, but watching it last night, it felt like the scenes were just kind of increasing in frequency, if that makes sense. The cuts, like as it goes along, it's getting faster and faster and faster, and you find your pulse kind of quickening as a viewer, where your heart's racing a little bit and your pulse is quickening a little bit, and then it culminates with the iconic scene in this episode. First, he kills Konstantin Kovar, seemingly. When he doesn't have to, because he's done, Konstantin's beaten, and Anatoly tells him, we'll take care of this, and Oliver says, no, I'll make sure justice is served, and he kills him. He's not really after justice, he's after revenge. And then we cut to the present day, and we get that iconic moment where Oliver says, where Adrian says, so why did you kill all those people, Oliver? And he says, I wanted to, and I liked it, which created a gif and a meme and all that other stuff. And that scene holds up so well, Nick. I think this is still, to this day, one of the finest acting performances from Stephen Amell that we've seen.
I would say it is the finest acting performance of Stephen Amell across the entire series.
Yeah.
And has not been topped, even to date, in the ultra-emotional season 8. Like, there really has not been anything that has put Oliver through the ringer quite like this episode.
Yep.
And knowing my love of such things in superhero media, that pretty much tells you why it's my number one.
I've got a theory on that. I'm going to touch on that in a minute as well. Remind me to come back to that point. The scene is so amazing. The acting is so amazing. And the reason the acting in this episode is so fantastic from Stephen Amell is we see him in the complete realm of emotions. We see anger at the beginning. We see defiance. We see sadness. Where, remember the scene where he threatens Felicity and then he reveals that he knows where William is, and Oliver is almost can't even come up with the words. He says, I don't even know where he is. This, you're bluffing. I don't even know where he is. And then Adrian's like, yeah, but you know, I can find him. And there's that moment where Oliver has the tears falling, and then he's almost desperate. He becomes desperate at a certain point in the episode where he's just, what do you want from me, Adrian? What do you want me to say? And then he has the acceptance and the realization of the inevitability of what's going on. And then there's that just burst of raw emotion where you see the monster come out again, the monster that we've seen in the flashbacks, where he says, I wanted to and I liked it, that he's a sadist, essentially. And then there's that acceptance at the end of the episode where how many comic book shows in particular have you ever seen, Nick, that put the hero in a position where he accepts being beaten by the villain? Not many.
Very few. Very, very few.
And that's where we're left at the end of this episode. You talk about the bold storytelling of Oliver falling off a cliff. Just as bold is Adrian Chase, first of all, burning the Bratva tattoo off of Oliver's chest, which kind of eliminates the goal that Oliver has achieved at the end of these flashbacks. This whole flashback sequence ends with him getting his Bratva tattoo that we've seen since the beginning of the show, and now Adrian leaves his mark by burning that tattoo off of his chest. And now Oliver limps his way back to his home base and informs the team, as it is, that there is no more team. He's shutting everything down. He tells Felicity, I can't do this anymore. Adrian's right about me. Adrian's right about everything that he said. We're done. And he's beaten, and Diggle tries to stay behind, and Diggle tries to give him his patented inspirational speech, and Oliver's not having it. And the show ends with them parting, and they're done. Actually, that carries over to the next episode. I watched a little bit of the next episode after this, but this episode ends with him saying, "The team's done. I'm finished with this. I can't do it anymore." A bold ending to the episode, a depressing ending to the episode. And yet, an inevitable ending to the episode. We've seen in the flashbacks that some of what Adrian says is true. And the best villains, Nick, in all of fiction, tend to be the ones that have some element of truth to what they're saying.
Right. Even if we can't agree with their viewpoint, you know, we can kind of understand it to a certain degree. And this is one, that's certainly one of those examples. Prometheus or Adrian Chase has a very well-founded vendetta against Oliver Queen, and he points out a lot of things about Ollie that are both uncomfortable for Ollie to admit, but also uncomfortable for us as the viewer and the fan of the character to admit.
Yep, that's exactly right. The show makes this show has an ability when they do these kinds of episodes to make the audience uncomfortable. You feel uncomfortable in the climb, and you feel uncomfortable at the end of this episode with what. Even with the torture of seeing what Ollie's going through, you feel uncomfortable. You feel uncomfortable in the flashbacks, and then you feel real uncomfortable when you see him so thoroughly beaten in a way that you've never seen before. It's a level, and yet, I think it's a lesson that other shows and other media, comic books, wrestling, whatever you want to look at, can learn from in terms of it increases, in a weird way, your empathy for a character if you see them at their lowest point. And you see that they can be gotten to, and they can be beaten, and they can, just like any of us, they can feel defeated. And it's sad, and it sucks, and you have the hope and the expectation that they'll come through it on the other side. But I think sometimes some fans believe that the hero should not go through things like this. I believe that things like this make heroes more interesting.
Oh, undoubtedly. You know, that's been my standpoint for years. I as we talked about earlier, I love to see the emotional torture for heroes, not because I want to see them lose all the time or be beaten down, but because to me the most interesting thing about a hero is how they deal with the dark times, how they come out the other side. And you can't come out the other side without going through something traumatic. And that's kind of where I'm always at and where I get my rocks off, as it were.
Yes, it's sort of like how you can have the worst year of your career while beating all of your opponents.
Yes, exactly. You go through so much hardship after losing one match.
But the point that I was going to circle back to earlier, maybe there's an element of Oliver Queen in us, in that there's a dark side of us that our favorite episodes tend to be the ones that put our hero through the worst torture imaginable. Our favorite episodes involve him getting killed, maimed, emotionally and psychologically tortured. Even that episode from the prison season where he goes under the psychological torture at the hands of that doctor, you know, like,
yes,
it's those tend to be our favorite episodes. The ones where we see Oliver just, you know, Stephen Amell really has to dig into his emoting catalog to get through these episodes. But the thing is, they come back and they give us resounding finales too to pay off these things. So that's good too. But what ultimately is this episode's legacy for you, Nick? As you rewatched it, is this still your number one episode of Arrow?
Absolutely, because it is, to me, for my money, the best performance by Stephen Amell. And if you were going to show it somebody, really, one episode to illustrate how the character of Oliver Queen progresses over the course of the show, this one sums it up pretty damn well.
Absolutely. And one thing that we shouldn't let go by, we talked about the Lund Renaissance. We got to talk about Josh Segarra as Adrian Chase as well. Fantastic. His performance all season long on season 5 of Arrow is as good as we saw on the show from anybody. But in this episode in particular, he had to be great. He had to be menacing without being cartoonish, and he never crosses over that line. He never even comes close to that line. He is so believable in this role that he is so, like you said earlier, we don't agree with his viewpoint and we don't like him, but he makes it understandable to a degree how and why he is this way. And a lot of that, yes, the writing deserves credit for that, but a lot of that comes through in the performance of Josh Segarra.
Absolutely. Josh Segarra is outstanding. And while this is, you know, like I said, Oliver, you know, Stephen Amell's high point, this is probably also Josh Segarra's high point. Mm-hmm. These are two of the finest performances in the show's history taking place simultaneously.
It's another thread, and we talked about this briefly on our countdown episode as well. A lot of the best scenes on this show are when two characters are locked in a room with each other having a conversation, whether it was Oliver and Tommy in season one, whether it's Oliver and Prometheus here, Oliver and Felicity many times. It tends to be when the show can be at its strongest, when you almost jettison the outside action. And that's not to say anything bad about the action, because the action here is great. There's an excellent fight scene with Kovar and Oliver in the flashback sequence. Really good action across the board here. And such an amazing show. And both of these episodes just reminded me of the best of Arrow and all the things that I love about this show, the performances, the action, the flashbacks that were weaving in with the present day stuff. I guess the only regret is that we didn't really have a good Olicity episode in this, but certainly there are plenty of those throughout both of these seasons. What an outstanding show, and it was a nice walk down memory lane, Nick, to be able to watch these two shows that stand out above a crowded field of great Arrow episodes.
Absolutely.
Well, there you have it, folks. We're gonna call it quits on this part of the show. Take a break. We want to hear your thoughts on these episodes of Arrow, if you watched them along with us or if you're watching them on your own. And we want to also hear your thoughts on your favorite episodes of Arrow. Shoot us an email. Not an email. We don't have that. Shoot us a tweet at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. Join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. And let us know your thoughts on these episodes in particular, and also any others that you think should be in the running for the best episode of Arrow. We will take a break, and after these messages, we'll be back with all of our usual segments, reading, watching, the rundown. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back. For the hard traveling fanboys, Arrow Month, I'm Greg Phillips. Nick Duke's still here. We're still coming to you from Hoholoon Plaza, Vancouver, British Columbia. L-shaped studios, you know the drill. Well, it's about that time, Nick, to talk about the PN news and notes in the world of comic books and comic book related entertainment. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
It's time for a rundown.
Welcome to the rundown. Where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the rundown. Where we talk about movies too.
Not a whole lot on the slate this week, Nick, but let's kick it off with an update on a project neither one of us has watched yet, shall we?
Yeah, let's do that. Well, I'm sure we'll have lots of thoughts.
Yes. HBO's Watchmen showrunner, Damon Lindelof, that's a nice spoiler image, by the way, on the Watchmen article there. HBO's Watchmen.
I didn't look at it. Is there a spoiler image?
Yes, it shows Dr. Manhattan from the show.
Oh, great.
HBO's Watchmen showrunner Damon Lindelof has closed the door resoundingly on his long-running Willie Won't He public decision-making about returning for a second season of the series. Apparently, Lindelof has no interest in a second season, but has given HBO his blessing to continue with somebody else if they want to. But HBO's chief programming officer says it would be hard to imagine doing it without Damon involved in some way. Nick, we haven't watched Watchmen Season 1. I've lost my access to HBO. But we'll regain it in a few months. I gotta say, I don't say this often, but good for Damon Lindelof. I'm shocked.
Mm-hmm.
I'm shocked that he's not going to do a second season. But I say good for him if he told his story and he got out of town. I admire that.
I bet they still do a second season a few years down the road.
Does it make money? Then yes. They can't resist. No one can resist in Hollywood. No one. As I jokingly said on Twitter, if Chris Farley was still alive, we'd be getting Tommy Mann today. Or might have already had it at that point. Well, let's stick to the theme here and talk about another Damon, shall we?
Sure.
Not Matt Damon. But Damon Gupton.
Not Johnny Damon?
No, not Johnny Damon. Not Johnny Damon. He looked like the Monday Night Messiah, Seth Rollins.
Hmm.
Damon Gupton exits Black Lightning. Are you ready for this, folks? He plays Chief Bill Henderson in the first three seasons of Black Lightning. He will not return in the fourth season. He was told that Chief Henderson was not in the plans. I think this is I understand it, and everybody eventually has to leave these shows, but it kind of sucks because he's. I know I'm way behind. I'm a season and a half behind on the show, but he was one of my favorite characters. I really enjoyed his dynamic with Jefferson and with his family on this show. I'm going to miss him.
Yeah, I've enjoyed him as well. He's provided something. He's added to the dynamics of the show. So I'm interested to see how they fill his screen time going forward.
Indeed, it is quite perplexing. We'll have to see what happens there. Well, let's move over to back to HBO actually. To the original Damon property we talked about. And let's go to the adaptation of DMZ, which was a comic book by Brian Wood, I believe. And that is being adapted by HBO. And Rosario Dawson has been cast as Alma Ortego, the lead role in DMZ. This is based on the Vertigo series by Brian Wood and Riccardo Bertelli. I'm not sure what the timeline is on this show. I know that Ava DuVernay is producing, but DMZ is an interesting project. Nick, are you familiar with it at all?
Vaguely.
It's interesting because I read the first volume of DMZ and I honestly was unimpressed. I usually get, you know, I'm usually when I read these critically acclaimed Vertigo series, I'm kind of, I walk away at least somewhat impressed, and DMZ just kind of bored me more so than I thought it would. Nonetheless, sometimes these adaptations turn out better than the source material, or at least to me better sometimes. So I'm going to give this a shot. I like Rosario Dawson a lot. and excited to see where this one goes. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, don't know anything about the comic, but you know, with the talent that's attached to include Rosario Dawson now, and the budgets and production values that HBO Max is promising, I mean, this probably will wind up being something to keep an eye on.
Here's an interesting one to close out on. Let's go to the worlds of DC EU extended multiverse corner. Are you ready, Nick?
I'm ready.
J.J. Abrams, controversial figure at the moment, apparently, but nonetheless, J.J. Abrams and his Bad Robot Studios are entering the world of DC Comics, it appears. Because the report is that they are exclusively developing Justice League Dark film and TV projects as part of a 5-year overall deal with Warner Media. This is according to Deadline. Bad Robot is reportedly booking meetings now with writers for several specific projects under the umbrella. Characters possibly under that umbrella would include John Constantine, Madame Xanadu, Swamp Thing, Deadman, Shade the Changing Man, Zatanna, Phantom Stranger, and a personal favorite of yours, Nick, Detective Chimp.
There we go.
So what do we make of this? This announcement came out of nowhere to me, Nick. I thought this project was dead and buried. Now it apparently is alive and being directed by the helmer of one of the biggest movie franchises of all time.
Well, we don't know that for sure. I mean, note they say true. His production company is taking it over, and they're not sure what form that will take. The real big positive note here for me is they talk about television properties for individual characters, which would suggest to me a level of patience in their storytelling that they haven't really shown as it relates to the Justice League at this point. And it will be very, very sad indeed if we wind up having more emotional investment because of the patience of the storytelling in a Justice League Dark movie than we did in a Justice League movie.
I'm also curious if there is a chance that they could revive the Swamp Thing series that we saw on DC Universe, which neither of us have watched yet. But I wonder if there's a chance for that to be salvaged as a part of this arrangement as well. That would be interesting.
Yeah, possibly, but you would have to think that J.J. Abrams would probably want to do his own take on Swamp Thing rather than being tied to this take that he had no involvement in developing.
It's too bad we haven't yet reached the part where Disney can buy DC Comics, because then we could have the reveal that Emperor Palpatine is Swamp Thing's grandfather.
That would be good. We could also get Kevin Feige doing DC movies, so, you know.
We could get Superman and Thor in a galactic battle where the Hulk dies in the end.
Legitimately, Warner Brothers has got all the money in the world. Would it be worth it to go to Kevin Feige and say, we will give you a literal $1 billion to come do this?
I mean, why not?
Like, eventually you would get a return on your investment at some point.
That's true. You would. Or... you go to George Lucas. George, you're not doing much these days. We'll give you a green screen. We can see maybe that secret crisis thing that was planted, the seed for which was planted in Doomsday Clock, could be paid off on the big screen instead of in the printed page.
Maybe it could be. George Lucas will do it. We get lines from Damian Wayne talking about how much he hates sand after growing up in the desert and stuff.
Father. What have you done to me, Father? That being said,
every fight scene would end with somebody shouting, "I have the high ground."
Yes, you do. You're Superman. You're flying, for God's sake. Sinestro always has the high ground on everyone, though. So he always has to float just a little bit higher.
Yep.
And that's why we love him. Well, that's the end of that. So let's move on to our next segment, where we talk about what we've been reading and watching in the world of comics, a segment known to many in some countries as Reading and Watching. What you been reading and watching? I have been reading something, Nick. Can you believe it?
I can't. Tell me about it.
I will. Well, as you know, a couple episodes ago, last episode, we talked about the Arrow Season 2.5 comic book on DC Universe app. I picked it up after we finished with issue 12, and I have now read the subsequent 7 issues, I believe, of it. 6 issues of it. I am now on issue 19 or 20 of the series, and I just found myself wanting to find out where it goes to bridge the gap between those two seasons, 2 and 3. And some interesting stuff happening in there. The final fate of the Arrowverse Black Adam is revealed, and it comes at the hands of Ra's al Ghul. And also, we see the wrap-up of the Brother Blood story arc. That's sort of brought to a fairly definitive end. And Roy ends up having to make a difficult choice in that one. And then we get a new arc about that kid from the very beginning, if you remember, that watched his parents die. Watched his dad kill his mom. If you remember that character? He comes back in a big bad way with Mirakuru powers. And so he's kind of the current big bad of the new arc that I'm reading. So I've really enjoyed it. The writing has been solid. The art has been good from Joe Bennett. And we're starting to see some of the things that would carry over into season 3. I became particularly inspired after I watched The Climb last night, because I was like, gosh, now I'm remembering the status quo, so I wonder what we get to see there. No more Thea and Malcolm yet, though, interestingly enough.
Good to hear that you're enjoying that. I might check that out at some point as well.
There is also a brief an issue where they break Huntress out of prison to help Oliver with a promise of something in return. And that was a pretty good episode or issue as well, because I had actually forgotten about the Huntress's very existence, I think. So that's good. That was very good. What about watching? You been watching anything, Nick?
Well, I made reference to the fact that I've been continuing my Arrow rewatching. You know, it just not to add on too much from what we've said in the first half of the show, but just continues to remind me how good the show was pretty much during its early years, how unlikable Laurel was during the early years, and how Oliver and Felicity's chemistry and dynamic was so outstanding from the jump, and they made the right choice in going with it full term.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that you can tell. Even I'm still on season 1 with my rewatch, but you can tell even early on, Laurel just wasn't working as a lead character, so to speak, and they kept her on to their credit, and they kind of adjusted to that as it went along, which is another cool thing, that they kind of pivoted towards her being almost an intentionally annoying character as time goes on. And she certainly is annoying. She blames everybody else for her problems. She, continually gives Oliver lectures about everything. So she's very much a Rachel Dawes in Batman Begins character in the first season. And then in the second season, she just turns into this completely unlikable creature, like monster of her own creation. So that's going to be fun to experience for me as well. And that chemistry with Ollie and Felicity is incredible. I have finished watching, and this is a little outside of the purview of the show, but I'll mention it anyway. I finally finished watching The Mandalorian this past week, which was, as anybody that saw my social media, I was blown away. What a great show. It dipped a little bit for me in episode 4, and maybe a little bit in 5 wasn't the best, but boy, does it rebound with those last 3 episodes. Holy mackerel. Including the last 2 episodes in particular, just being tremendous. So tremendous. I can't wait to see more of this show. I thought everybody was great on it. And how awesome to see Carl Weathers looking so vibrant and bringing so much to his character. I enjoyed the hell out of that.
Yep, I loved it as well.
And, believe it or not, Nick, I have finally started playing Batman Arkham Knight.
Oh, man.
What am I, 5 years behind the times now?
Yeah, only about that. 5 years.
And let me tell you,
and it only takes about 2 more years to finish it.
That's right. That's right. That's right, Stevie. I suck at this game, by the way. I absolutely suck. There's no getting around it. I haven't played an Arkham game in so long that I couldn't remember how to play it, so I'm trying to figure it out as I go. Now I'm trying to figure out how to drive the damn Batmobile, which ain't going well for me at the moment. It's gonna be a journey, and I'm playing it on the easiest difficulty setting. So, So, but I don't have any shame in that. I want to experience the story. So, F it. I'm too old to be caring about such things. So I plus I got so many other games I got to play eventually that I need to get through this, enjoy the story, enjoy the DLC, and move on. But like you said, it'll probably take me 2 years.
It probably will.
And then other than that, I can't think of anything else comic book related I've been experimenting with lately. Hopefully I'll be able to read some more books soon. But nonetheless, let's move on to the clock on the wall says 3 o'clock. Last call for alcohol. No, it says it's time for the Wrestling Minute.
Oh, there it is.
Oh, my goodness gracious, Nick. The Wrestling Minute. So much going on in the world of sports entertainment. The Jericho Cruise, the Chris Jericho Rockin' Wrestling Rager. C.
Yep.
Part D.
Part two. Yep.
Is going on right now. AEW Dynamite.
Now, Part D, does it have any similarities to Dews as a, you know, Canadian aspirin?
I don't know. Or you know, Canadian Michael Hayes, perhaps.
No, that was a Chris Berman. A Chris Bermanism. There's video of him talking to someone during commercial break, talking about how you always want two or three Blue Jay games a year because you can go to the Canadian pharmacy where they sell with a Canadian aspirin just cut with a little bit of codeine, and you shove them down in the liner of your suitcases. You can take them back into the States, and they call them dews.
maybe that's why I go so much. Just saying. But no, so that's going on. We got the Dynamite was filmed there on the cruise. NXT's got big title matches coming up. We've got the Royal Rumble is upon us, believe it or not. It feels like it's not, but it is. Takeover is going to take place. Not Takeover. The Worlds Collide is taking place on Saturday between NXT UK and NXT. What's catching your eye in the world of wrestling right now, Nicholas?
That Worlds Collide card looks pretty fun. Looks different. Looking forward to that big 8-man tag that's going to, I would assume, serve as the show's main event. It'd be interesting to see how they book it, considering it's two heel stables in the main event against one another. And then, of course, the Rumbles themselves are always a fun time. Always good to kick off the road to WrestleMania, which you and I will be in attendance for again.
Oh, making our yes.
Grand return to the granddaddy of them
I'm
all.
Excited. So. I'm excited. I'll be more excited as we get closer to it. And we're ready to rock and roll in the Tampa Bay area, enjoying some good old-fashioned wrestling action. Nothing better in the world. But I guess since it is our show and we like to throw out all of our hot takes on pop culture and wrestling and all that stuff, let's give two predictions here, Nick, separate predictions. Let's give mm-hmm. who we think will win each Royal Rumble and who should win each Royal Rumble. I'll start us off with the men's Royal Rumble.
Yes.
Roman Reigns will win the Royal Rumble.
Yes. Roman Reigns is going to win the Royal Rumble, yes.
And challenge Bray Wyatt, the Fiend, at WrestleMania. And Drew McIntyre should win the Royal Rumble and challenge Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania.
Mm. Roman Reigns will win. I'm with you there. But I think Kevin Owens or Samoa Joe should win the Royal Rumble. One of those two guys. Either or. Take your pick.
If it would be Owens, that would be a fresh matchup for Brock.
That's
if
true.
If he challenges Brock, assuming.
Yes.
And let's all hope that Roman Reigns doesn't win the Royal Rumble and then challenge Brock Lesnar.
Oh, God.
Been there, done that. Got the shirt.
So many times.
Now, the Women's Royal Rumble. This is more intriguing. I'll let you start there.
The answer for this is one and the same. Shayna Baszler will win the Women's Royal Rumble, and she should win the Women's Royal Rumble.
Very good. Very good. And I'm going to say the same thing. We're going to make it a clean sweep here. That's not as fun because I was tempted to say Charlotte will win it. Because I think there's always a chance of that, and they go back to Charlotte and Becky. But I'm gonna play the safe game here, or play the intuition game here. I feel the same way. I think Shayna Baszler should and will win the Royal Rumble and challenge. Do we agree here? Challenge Becky Lynch at WrestleMania.
Challenge Becky Lynch at WrestleMania. Yes,
very
yes,
good.
Indeed.
And going down the rest of the card in the big matches, Fiend beats Daniel Bryan.
Of course.
And I'm actually thinking that what's her name against Bayley? Lacey Evans might beat Bayley to transition the title to Sasha.
Interesting. I think it's more likely that you get Bayley or Sasha turning on the other during the build to WrestleMania is my prediction.
Very interesting. That's more preferable, I think. But and then I don't know any other big matches that are going on. But interesting nonetheless. Oh, I will say one more wrestling thought. Very much credit goes, in my opinion, to what Heyman and company are doing on Raw lately. The Lana and Bobby Lashley stuff is terrible. It's not working. They need to jettison that. But other than that, I think they've done a pretty commendable job of increasing the interest in some of the other things that are going on. Andrade has been built very well in recent weeks. Humberto Carrillo, for the first time ever in his career, feels like he has a little bit of a heat behind him heading into his rivalry with Andrade. And those cheeks, my boy. And then the other thing that I really think has kind of saved Raw in some ways from the doldrums of December is Seth Rollins' new heel faction that he's got, who I've kind of deemed the saviors of sorts with his Monday Night Messiah character, kind of based on Negan a little bit. You've got Buddy Murphy and the AOP, and it works. They had their first like group promo on Monday, and I thought it really worked. So I'm a fan of factions in general, Nick, and I think this was a wise move on the part of WWE and Heyman in particular.
Yeah, I would agree. And now let's see if maybe not a faction, but a face alliance can rise up and give them a compelling, compelling counterpoint. Kevin Owens and Samoa Joe are a good start. I don't know that the Viking Raiders are necessarily cut out for a more realistic, heated storyline given their characters, but there continue to be rumors about getting Rey Mysterio and Aleister Black involved, which would be outstanding. So lots of different directions they can go, and looking forward to see how it all plays out. But speaking of wrestling, you know, once again, we're going to bring to you today, as we close the show, a little musical number from WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross. Good old Jim Ross, who right now is actually abroad. JR is traveling. He is in the Bahamas. With the aforementioned Chris Jericho's Rockin' Wrestling Rager ship thing, part do. And I understand, Jim, that on this boat there are lots of women, lots of single eligible women there. I know you're a single eligible guy now with your Bluetooth and stuff, and I thought it was appropriate that you sing a little song about kind of your pickup line and what you've been saying to these women as you've taken to the high seas. So, JR, take it away.
Well, first of all, Nick, I just want to say that this trip has been a disaster. I have not enjoyed my trip to the Bahamas. I enjoy calling her Action now. The action was great. Action in the ring was great. Haven't liked anything else about it, but you know, you're right. There are a lot of women around, and I'm single. I'm ready to mingle. I like some of these folks. They're nice looking. And it left me thinking this thing. You know, and I've delivered some of these lines, by the way, in recent days. I really have, Conrad. I've talked to some of the ladies, and I've let them know kind of where they stand with me. Anyway, here's how the song goes.
Once again, I am not Conrad Thomas.
Well, whatever. This is how the song goes. It starts out a little bit something like this. You have been looking for love all around the world. Baby, don't you know that this country girl is still free? So why not me? Well, you finally come down to your old hometown. This Oklahoma girl has been waiting patiently. Why not me? Why not me on a rainy day? Why not me to love your cares away? Why not me? Why not me when the nights get stone cold? Why not me when you're growing old? Why the hell not me? You've been searching from here to Sooner Country. Ain't it time that you notice the girl next door, baby? Well, why not me? You had to go see if the world was round. It's time that you learned how good settling down could be. Like when you settle into a side headlock. Why not me? Why not my ass on a rainy day? Why not my ass to love your cares away? Pardon me. Why not me? Why not me, Stone Cold? Why not me when you're growing old? Why in the hell not me? So, you've been looking for wrestling all around the world. Baby, don't you know that AEW Dynamite on TNT is still free? You've been looking for love all around the world. Baby, don't you know that AEW Dynamite on TNT is still free? So, baby, why not me? Our traveling fanboys.